Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. Well, the bad news that I have to give you, unfortunately, is that due to circumstances beyond our control, we're not able to bring you a brand new edition of At Home This Morning this week. So we're repeating the edition that came out in January, which was a retrospective of the best bits of the programmes that we broadcast during 2016. One of the most significant events in 2016 was the first ever Brighton and Hove Older People's Festival, which took place over a period of about 2 weeks, centred around the United Nations Older People's Day, which is October the 1st. Not long after the festival had started, I spoke to its organiser, Caroline Ridley, of Impact Initiatives, and I began by asking her how the festival came about.
For several years now, there's been various celebrations across Brighton and Hove to acknowledge the United Nations Day for Older People, which is on the 1st of October. The last 3 years, Impact Initiatives have put on various events, and the highlight has been the Brighton Hove Older People's Awards. This year, Brighton Hove Council, again, we're putting up some funding to do something along those lines. We decided to do things a bit differently. And because there'd been such a good response to all the different smaller events that we've put on, we decided to make the Brighton Hove Older People's Festival. So it's connected to the United Nations Day, but it's also around and building on the Brighton Hove City Council working towards status as an age-friendly city.
It's quite a big step going from a one-day celebration to a 12-day festival, isn't it?
It has been a big step. We went from an early meeting before we put the bid in to the council. It's Public Health who are funding a lot of it. And we came up with a few ideas. And then once we'd been awarded the funding and we put the word out, it's just grown and grown and grown. And it's been absolutely fantastic that so many different organisations have wanted to put on events. People have come up with ideas of things they'd like help to put on. We've had amazing involvement from local businesses who have sponsored things. For example, the printing of all the brochures, they're doing all the designing of the festival programme, all our banners, posters, website, businesses helping to put on events. It's just been fabulous, the amount of support and the number of people who are wanting to get involved.
So what's the aim of the festival?
The aim of the festival is partly to dispel the myths about ageing and older people. And it's also working towards the Brighton Hove City Council bid to get age-friendly city status. So it's about having older people much more visible, being seen out and about, but also about what the older people actually contribute to the city. I think Brighton Hove seemed very much as a place for younger people, and actually it's something like 38,000 people over the age of 50 in the city who are a large majority are very busy, very active and keeping things running, contributing in many ways, some through childcare for their families, but huge numbers of people in that age group volunteering as well.
Yes, since I've been presenting this programme, I've discovered a huge amount of activities that older people are involved in, and indeed organisations for older people that I didn't know about before.
I mean, it is phenomenal. One of the key things this year is there's a photographic exhibition by Brighton-based Maria Scard, which is on display at the Dome at the moment. And I think in doing the photography exhibition, we've come across people that we hadn't before. And, you know, we work with older people week in, week out, but there's still more and more out there. I mean, a fantastic example is there, a couple who, when they retired, bought a van and turned it into a kitchen, and they go out every day cooking up bacon sandwiches and feeding the homeless community. And all very sort of unknown about, really. So, yeah, huge amount of work going on.
And you're defining older people as being anyone over 50, are you?
I'm following what the United Nations define as older people. So, yeah, that's officially what the United Nations classes an older person. So there's a lot of us.
So it's a twofold aim for the festival, really, to showcase what older people are doing and also to tell older people about activities they could be involved in.
It is, yeah, and sort of just keeping people out and about and active, but giving opportunities for people to go out and try something new as well. I mean, for example, there's backstage tours of the Theatre Royal and a chance to go and sit in the dressing room, pretend you're a big star, have your photograph taken. There's been a trip to Parliament, which, unfortunately, we could take one minibus full. I believe we could have filled a coach to go up there. We've got a Soul and Motown evening on Saturday night at the Hot 50 Plus. So, yeah, just new opportunities for people to get out and about.
And to try out activities that they might like to get involved in, possibly.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's been bowling challenges. We've had a boccia tournament. There's dance classes. The list goes on and on.
Now, the festival started on Monday, September the 27th, didn't it?
It did indeed, yes. So started on Monday and we run through until next Friday.
So that's October the 7th. How's it going so far?
It's going really well. We've had some brilliant feedback. I've mentioned the trip to Parliament, which people there had a fantastic time, I think completely overwhelmed by some parts of the building and the information they got. There was also a debate at Dorothy Stringer School between some of their pupils and the Older People's Council, the topic being, do older and younger people have more in common than the media would portray? And I believe the vote at the beginning and the vote at the end, there was quite a big difference in change of opinion, which is what debate's about. So that was fantastic. We've had various events going on, teaching people different things about IT, how to use tablets, laptops. We've got 3D printing at the Barclays Eagles Lab. And just lots of people out there having a really good time and learning something in the process.
It sounds very, very interesting and very varied, certainly. Is Impact Initiatives particularly concerned with older people?
One of our key service areas is working with older people, but in fact Impact work with people of all ages, so we range from 0 to 100 years old in the people that we support. We have an after-school project based in Whitehall, the WASP after-school project. We have a young people's centre based in Brighton where people can get advice and counselling. We have 5 young houses for young women, 2 of those are for young women with their babies. And then across West Sussex as well, we have employment support services and advocacy for adults as well. So I think that's what we are unique in, that we work with all age groups.
Which is very useful if you want to try and get them together, of course.
It is, and it has. We've done various joint projects across the services. One of the previous Older People's Day celebrations, we had a group of older people going down to meet the children at the after school club, and that went really well. They had a fantastic time with the older people coming up with different games that the children had never heard of, and really enjoyed playing. It was like having a whole bunch of grandparents all visit on the same day. And I think the older people enjoyed it as well. Some of the younger people were, showing them some of the computer games. There was a fantastic moment with one of the children thinking he was teaching one of the older people something new on one of the Xbox games, and then the older person beat him, which was a very amusing moment and good for everybody, I think.
Thank you very much, Caroline.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I was talking to Caroline Ridley about the first Brighton and Hove Older People's Festival, which took place at the end of September, beginning of October. As you may gather, that interview was actually recorded on September the 29th, which was about halfway through the festival. As you heard, it seemed to be going well at the time, and indeed it went very well right up to the end. Well, moving on, or possibly back if you like, back in July, we heard about a couple of initiatives that the Brighton and Hove Bus and Coach Company have taken to help older passengers. Here's Maya Davis to tell us more.
Well, I was recently on a number one bus and filled in a survey which mentioned that this particular bus now carried an induction loop to help the driver talk to people with hearing difficulties. And at the end, it mentioned a scheme called Safe Haven and another scheme called Helping Hands, and flagged up that this scheme could be of use to people with dementia. So I thought, well, let's ask the bus company about it. I rang them up, and we have a representative of the bus company in today. I'll ask her to introduce herself.
My name is Rachel Beckett. I am the coaching team leader of Brighton Hove Bus and Coach Company.
Today you're talking about a scheme called Safe Haven, and you're talking about dementia-friendly training on buses. Can you tell me how you got into that?
So my original background is as a carer, both in my own home and also employed. And when I changed careers and moved into the transport industry, it was very clear that it's an industry that is also affected by all sorts of conditions. There aren't many industries where you see all of life all together. So the Safe Haven scheme and the dementia-friendly work is really a recognition that the public need more support than the driver is able to offer it if he doesn't know how to offer that support.
So this is a recent development by the bus company?
We initially brought it in at the start of 2015, and it's been sort of growing, and obviously the more people who know about it, the more people can make use of it. And to go along with this, we introduced our Helping Hand scheme just before that, so at the end of 2014. Which is designed to allow anybody, regardless of their needs or their sort of affection, that they can let the driver know a very simple message that will make their bus journey easier. It may just be as simple as please lower the step, or it may be a very specific instruction, sort of please face me, I lip read, is a very common one. And that really helps the driver and the passengers to have a much sort of smoother and a much safer journey.
So this is a card they have to carry, is that right?
Yeah, it's a yellow card. It's a credit card sort of size and thickness. They're completely free. We make them ourselves sort of for passengers, and then we post them out to them. And it doesn't matter whether you've got dementia or you've got hearing problems, sight problems. The cards are not specific to a set condition. It's just about being able to pass a very simple instruction on to the driver. We have also spoken to all of the other bus companies in the area so that they will also sort of recognise them and accept them. And so the idea is that Brighton will have a consistently positive journey for people using our bus network. We've also taken the decision not to brand them so that they do work everywhere, rather than it being limited to just a Brighton and Hove bus. We've even tried them on London Underground, and they went down really, really well. And I'm aware that other companies across the country are now introducing similar schemes to try and improve passenger experience, but also help the driver.
So do the cards have a specific piece of information on, for example, I am deaf? Or is it an instruction to the driver or whoever else might be reading those cards?
From our perspective, we would like the card to have an instruction for the driver. Very simple commands that the driver can just act on. We do have some passengers who would rather state what their condition is. The main example of that is people who have Tourette's or have epilepsy, where from their perspective, it's more useful to let the driver and other passengers know what their needs are through that method. But we are entirely led by what the individual passenger wants to put on their card. And as long as it physically fits on the card, we will go with whatever's best for the individual.
So if they wanted to write, I have dementia, that's fine?
Yes. It's absolutely fine. We just feel that in our experience of talking to passengers, a lot of passengers don't want to have to let people know what their conditions are. They might be in a queue of three or four people getting on the bus and they don't want Mrs. Jones to know what they're living with. So by focusing on having an instruction, it removes any need for that. And often other passengers aren't even aware that a card's been shown.
So you're actually putting in place a system that might roll out nationally.
I think it will become a much more national thing. I know that other companies, certainly in Bristol, Newcastle, all around the country are now realising that people do need more support. And also your staff need more support. It's very difficult to expect your staff to be able to support everybody all of the time and to get it right all of the time. So if you give them a tool that alleviates that problem, then you're instantly improving your own staff's working day and your public's. And ultimately, if you work in the public sector, they're the key to you keeping going.
So the drivers have responded well and you feel the scheme's going really well?
Yeah, and certainly we've had more and more uptake across the city. There's well over 1,000 cards in circulation in the city, some that are held by individuals, and we've had some charities that have chosen to order a large number of cards so that they can give them out to their residents as and when they need to. We also have the option on the card, and it is entirely optional, for people to put emergency contact details on the back so that if they do need somebody contacting, the driver knows what to look for and then can then make that decision as to who to call. But that is entirely at the choosing of the person, whether they want that or not.
OK, so now let's move on to the dementia-friendly side of things. Do you train your drivers?
We do. Currently, the drivers go through a standard training process where every 5 years they have to complete 35 hours of accredited classroom training. We took the decision this year to focus very much on the public and on customer services, and dementia is a part of that. So in their training each year, they go through the Dementia Friends videos, they go through scenarios of how dementia can affect people and how they as bus drivers and in their own lives can make a big difference to people with dementia.
And what's their response to that?
Generally, the drivers find it really, really supportive. The biggest comment we have constantly is, oh, I wish I'd known that earlier. And the amount of stories you hear when a driver suddenly twigged that lady or that gentleman probably did have some form of dementia, and that explained all of their confusion. We have noticed that as a driver, it also gives you a huge amount of confidence to feel that you've had some training and some support from those in the company to be able to support somebody living with dementia. And they're much more likely to actually ask somebody if they need some help, rather than being a bit more worried and trying to move the situation on as quickly as possible.
So when a bus driver realises that one of the customers on the bus has dementia and that help is needed, what sort of things can they do?
It might be as simple as asking them which bus stop they want. Often we've found in the last sort of 20 years, as bus routes have changed, bus numbers have changed, the buses themselves have obviously changed, people are adamant they want a certain stop, and they may in fact be on completely the wrong bus, but 5 years ago they would have been on the correct bus. So simple things like the driver being able to ask which stop they want. If they are on the wrong bus, they can then direct them to the right place, and if they're on the right bus, they can then let the passenger know when they get to the correct stop. If someone is on the wrong bus, complementing the Helping Hand scheme, the idea of the Safe Haven scheme is that a driver could take a passenger to our head office in Hove or to our customer base at North Street, and they can safely wait there until the bus they actually need comes along. So as well as training the drivers, we've also trained all of our customer service staff and all of the management as well on recognising dementia as a condition and looking for ways to support people.
Now, you talked about the drivers being able to take customers who needed extra safety to either the bus office in North Street or your main office in Hove.
Yeah.
What happens if those two places are closed? I mean, you're not open all the time, are you?
No. We are open up a lot. The idea is that eventually these safe havens will spread across the city. So the hope is that some of the places that are open 24 hours will take up the Safe Haven scheme. as their own model. And we've certainly had other organisations who are willing to get involved in that. And I think the plan is that eventually across Brighton, and even wider than that in Sussex as well, there will always be somewhere that people can go if they feel vulnerable.
And that will apply to anybody, an old person who maybe is worried about going home on his or her own in a darkened area, people with dementia, people who are not sure where they are, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the idea for us, for staying away from any kind of branding or any kind of labelling of the schemes, is that they will be accessible for all. We recognise that there are so many conditions and so many situations, some of which can be very temporary and some are much more long term. So we need to be able to support everyone as best we can, even if it is just a matter of, as it often is for us, making someone a cup of tea and just helping them work out which journey they actually wanted to make. And then obviously you have some more extreme cases where people actually need sort of immediate help, either from medical services or from the police, but they're in a much more relaxed and calm environment to have that support.
Do you have any advice for carers of people with dementia or any other conditions who might not be able to contact you themselves, but who would like to get a card and who would like the other person, the person they're caring for, to know about your scheme?
My best advice is always to go to our website, buses.co.uk. The application form for a Helping Hand card is on there. You can also call up our customer services office, which is 01273 886 200. We can also create the card for them over the phone. And then there is the option of coming into one of our offices and having a chat with us. And we can make the card then and there. Our hope is that more and more organisations will sort of recognise the scheme. And often we've had groups like the Blind Veterans have ordered their own bulk amount of cards so that people can get hold of a card much more easily. So the other option is to sort of approach your social worker, approach sort of residential home managers if you're in that setting, and ask them to approach us on their behalf and see what support we can offer.
That sounds pretty comprehensive, and it sounds as though Brighton and Hove Buses are doing something of benefit to everybody. Thank you very much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Maya Davis was talking to Rachel Beckett of the Brighton and Hove Bus and Coach Company about their Helping Hands and Safe Haven schemes. You can find out more about the schemes from their website, which is at www.buses.co.uk. Well, now we're going even further back in the year, to May, when one of our reporters, Joan Fraser, told us about an interesting letter that she'd recently received. And this is what she said.
It was sent to me very recently from the wife of a charming couple, if I can put it like that, that I met about 6 years ago. It's quite an odd story, really. I joined a Keep Fit class, Margaret Morris movement, and it was all full of ladies of a certain age like myself, except one day one rather good-looking 50-ish chap came in, tall, dark and handsome, and joined the class. And he was from Ecuador, it turned out, because I was speaking to him. All the others seemed a bit frightened of him in case they thought he was flirting with them. Well, I didn't care whether he thought I was flirting with him. I was just interested in him. Anyway, we got to chat, and the class was fun, and it was made more fun because he was there. And then came the Christmas lunch, as it does with these things, and he was seated next to me, and we got talking, and a very nice chap. He was teaching at Sussex University, very interested in neuroscience. And I said, well, you know, my husband is extremely interested in neuroscience. He has a great many books on the neuroscience and enjoys reading about it very much. And they then invited us to their flat, and Enos, his delightful wife, had at that time what seemed to be very little English, but in fact she could understand me, she told me, which was rather complimentary. Anyway, we became friends with them, and over a period of 6 years we met them from time to time and enjoyed their company, and they seemed to enjoy ours. Anyway, I think the Christmas before last, we hadn't seen them for a while, and one sent the usual Christmas card about, oh, you know, we really must meet up. And we had a reply from her, or a phone call, to say, so pleased to hear from us, because at the end of that particular week, they were moving to Madrid after 6 years of living in England, first in Hove and then out at Falmer, because they were both at the university there. And so they came to tea. This was just before last Christmas. And then subsequently to that, I had this letter from them, which I thought was so moving. And it speaks very well to the fact that her English is richer probably than mine, if I can say that. But it's beautifully written, in my view. So see what you think. Thank you for your email, for the lovely afternoon in your house, and for your wishes. We arrived safe in Madrid, and we are happy to be here. I want to share with you and Peter a text that I wrote before we left. And this is it. Bye-bye, Great Britain. Today we have left you. Thank you for 6 wonderful years that we will never forget. 6 years full with memories that now are part of us. After all this time, I have learnt why your name is Great Britain. It is great not just because of your history, your kings and queens, your music, science, art and literature that you have exported and export, your breathtaking landscapes, woods and gardens, your country houses in which time has been frozen, your magnificent London. You are great because of the immense kindness and generosity of your people, because of the books I have read when I walked your paths, because of the challenge of understanding the sounds of your language, because here I have learned how to enjoy life in spite of the rain and the cold, because of the way I felt in love with my plants, my gardens, with walking through your land in the company of the wind, because of your beaches with pebbles, your freezing sea, because of the dancing clouds of starlings, the golden sunsets painting the canvas of your white cliffs, for the seasons that made me hear the rhythm of the time flowing, because of your ales and the warm beer, the pork belly, the roasted lamb, and the single malted whiskey. Thank you, Great Britain, for the lovely friends you have given me and that are coming with me in my heart. It has been a privilege for me to live within your borders. You will always be great for me.
Joan Fraser told us about an interesting letter that she'd recently received. Well, now we're going back to the spring of 2016, when our reporter Maya Davis went out on location to the site of a dig that the Brighton and Hove Archaeological Society were carrying out just alongside Ovingdean Church, on the site of an ancient manor house. To find out about what was going on, she spoke to the dig director, John Skelton.
So tell me a little bit about this dig. I see you're in a field surrounded by horses next to Ovingdean Church, and there seems to be a wall emerging. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, this field hasn't been ploughed in living memory, and certainly we've got no record of it ever being ploughed. And in the late 90s, members of our society noticed the humps and bumps in this field, which to an archaeologist is fantastic, because it suggests that there's archaeology under the surface. So they started doing geophysical surveys of the field and noticed a number of anomalies. And so several years later, they excavated near the church and found the remains of quite a substantial stone house. The walls were about a metre thick, suggesting it could have been two stories and it had a cellar. And the interpretation is that that is a manorial house. And so since then, we've been extending into the field to try and find other structures that would be associated with the manorial complex. Things like a barn, a dovecot, workshops, a detached kitchen, because the kitchens were a fire risk, so they had them detached. And the date of that stone building seemed to be about 1100 to 1350 on the basis of the pottery that was found associated with it.
So a little later than the church, which I think is 11th century?
Yeah, the earliest indications for the church are 11th century, but there's an idea that there was a Saxon church there prior. And the finds that we've been getting now, as you say, you can see a flint wall. We think that's quite a crude boundary wall. It's not the wall of a building. And the interesting thing is that under that, we've been finding a soil layer that has got Saxon pottery in it. So the indication is that there was Saxon settlement here prior to the Norman settlement.
And is any of this pottery going to end up in Brighton Museum?
All the finds from here will be offered to Brighton Museum. The site is owned by the local authority, so all the finds belong to the local authority. And the actual archive will be kept either at Brighton Museum or some other repository.
What's the most exciting thing you've found on the site so far?
2 years ago, in that Saxon lair, we found a bone disc about 2 inches in diameter. It was carved almost like a modern drafts piece, and we know that the Saxons were lovers of board games, so we think that may be a homemade, crude Saxon gaming piece, which is fantastic, if it is.
What else have you done apart from here?
In the recent years, we've done a number of small-scale excavations, mainly where there was some building work or park restoration work being done. It's what we call watching briefs. They are small-scale. The latest was in Victoria Park in Port Slade, where they were digging some drainage features, and we just went along there just in case they came across any archaeology. We've helped out professional organisations on occasions, involved with a dig on a Neolithic site in Seaford, right on the coast, where it is. You know, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, it will end up going into the sea.
Right, yeah.
So it's right, rescue archaeology.
And what are you intending to do with this site once you've explored it?
Hopefully, we will be able to apply for it to be registered as a scheduled monument, and that will protect it from any possibility of development. And means that the agricultural nature will not be able to be changed. It will never be allowed to be ploughed, for instance. If we can demonstrate fully that there was Saxon occupation on this site, it will become a very important, maybe of national importance, this site. It's Saxon remains sites are quite rare, and the chance to show continuity between Saxon occupation and then the Norman occupation on this site would be fantastic.
How do you recruit the diggers?
The site is open to anyone who wants to dig here, but we like them to be members of the society, which is only £15 a year, so it's not a great outlay. But most of the diggers actually are members of the society for many years, and they come on a regular basis. Most of us here are amateurs, very few with actual professional qualifications, but we try and do it to the same standards as the professionals where we can.
Would you say this was a particularly suitable activity for people to take up when they retire, particularly if they're interested in being out in the open and being active?
I think so, yes. It's not, as I say, it's not only the digging, we have other activities within the society, and we try to accommodate as many people as we can. I would say that most of our diggers here are retired. We like to encourage anyone to join, but obviously retired people tend to have more time to participate. We try and give people work that's suitable for their age, shall we say. If people have any disabilities, obviously we take that into account. And there are a variety of jobs to be done on site, not all of them digging. So there's lots of activities.
And you dig just on Wednesdays and Saturdays, is that right?
At the moment, yes. We may have some weeks during the summer where we try and get here more frequently, but generally it is a Wednesday and Saturday.
Okay. Now, how do people find out more? How do they join? How do they contact you?
We have a website, www.brightonarch.org.uk. On the website, there's information, there's application forms to download. There are phone numbers on there for the society in general and for specific members like the secretary. You can just come up to the site here at Ovingdean and you can join on site. At the moment, it's £15 a year. And then that will entitle you to go to the talks that we have, the day schools, and obviously to come along to the day.
So anyone who joins can make a contribution to their understanding of the local history and possibly contribute to general awareness of history in Brighton and Hove and maybe create a new attraction.
Absolutely. The possibility is that the site will be dug more extensively. Maybe not, but it may be. And you never know what might develop from that.
Right, thank you very much.
Maya Davis was talking to John Skelton of the Brighton and Hove Archaeological Society about a dig they're conducting next to Ovingdean Church. Now for our final item, we're going back to July of 2016, when we heard about a scheme called Hen Power. Nicola Benge came into the studio to tell me all about it.
It was set up about 5 years ago by a charity called Equal Arts, based in Gateshead, and they've been rolling the project out across the country because it's been so successful. Essentially, it's introducing hen keeping into sheltered housing schemes and care homes, really because a lot of those sort of places don't allow pets, and we really want to encourage older people to get out into the garden and also to have something else to think about, to have something else to be responsible for. And we find with hens that they're actually beautiful creatures that are not too difficult to look after, and they're very friendly, and also, you know, you get eggs from them. So we have, as part of that, partnered with a scheme in Brighton called Rosehill Court, and we built a hen run, and we've introduced six new hens to them, and they're getting along swimmingly. We've had our first batch of eggs, and they're very popular, and we're always happy to talk about ways that we can bring hens to your own scheme, if that's something you might be interested in. Or again, if you'd like to get involved as a volunteer and help feed our hens, you'd be very welcome.
So the idea is to try and spread the hen ownership around all the various sheltered housing blocks.
Yes, it is, yes. And really, it's just a lovely way to sort of get involved. And we have outings and we have creative activities weekly as part of that. So it's a great scheme to get involved in, and it's been very popular. If you want to find out more about Hen Power, if you just Google Hen Power, then all the information comes up, and you can find out about information all over the country. So if you have a relative in another part of the country, there's probably a Hen Power scheme waiting for them too.
Right, thanks very much, Nicola.
Thank you.
A few weeks later, I came across Nicola Benge again at a garden party at one of these sheltered housing schemes, and she'd got some hens with her. In front of us now are two very handsome hens, sort of mid-brown colour, pecking away at the grass.
Yeah. Well, we've laid some corn down for them, and they love that. A bit of someone's lunch as well.
All right.
Hen Power. It is new to Brighton. And we've set up a scheme introducing rescue hens to seniors' housing schemes in Brighton. The first one being in Rosehill Court, which is just off London Road. And we've got six hens there now, with the support of the scheme manager and of Brighton and Hove Council. And we're getting two more tomorrow. So we're saving the rescue hens from uncertain uncertain outcomes, and it means that they're laying wonderful eggs, the freshest you can get, and the residents buy the eggs for 20p each, and then that helps to pay for the feed for the hens. Yeah, so it's a sort of circular economy, really.
Yes, everyone benefits, including the hens.
Everyone does, yeah. I mean, the hens are so much healthier since we sort of saved them. So, and what we notice is the residents come out of their rooms a bit more, they're using the garden more, they're talking to the hens, they're saving up their food scraps. So it's encouraging composting a bit as well, I suppose.
Yes.
So it's been very popular. And we've got another one at Hyman Fine House, which is a Jewish care home in Kemp Town. And they've got, I think, four hens there. And we run a series of creative activities alongside that. So, you know, on a regular basis, we have artists come in and freelancers to run creative activities. And they're all free of charge.
Right. Now, you say these are rescued hens. Where do you rescue them from?
We actually got... The four we got that are rescue hens, we got from Raysteed Animal Sanctuary.
Oh, yes.
Which some of you may know is a sort of Ringmaway on the Broil. And they're fantastic there. They wanted to see exactly what we had built, so they knew they were going to a safe home and we were going to look after them properly. And then we got two Sussex breed hens from... Martin Woods Poultry Farm, which is in Ribe, so it's not that far from Raysteed, and they're the sort of purebred ones. And they're that's a blue haze and a Sussex light, so they're different colours. But we find these ones are they're called Warren variety, but they're sort of general hybrid hens, and they're the best layers, really, we find.
They're obviously very tame. They don't mind being surrounded by people and all the noise and so on.
No, they're lovely. I mean, they're very easygoing. I mean, they're great pets, really. You know, they're sort of quite low maintenance. You know, as long as there's someone to sort of put them to bed at night and get them up in the morning, they're pretty self-sufficient, really, and they eat most things. So they've been a great boon to Rosehill Court and the residents, and it's been lovely to have them there, really. It feels like they've always been there.
Okay, thanks very much, Nicola. Good luck with the continuation of the scheme.
Thanks very much, then. Thank you.
I was talking to Nicola Benge about the Hen Power scheme, which started in the summer of 2016. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time. But in the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me to let me know what you think of the programme, or perhaps to suggest items you might like me to cover in future editions, I'd love to hear from you. There are two ways of getting in touch. You can either contact me by email at the following address, info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, spelled I-N-F-O, at Grey Matters Productions, which is typed all as one word, .org.uk. Or you can contact me via the Radio Reverb website. If you go to the website and find the page that's devoted to At Home This Morning, you can send me an email from there. And whichever method you choose, I'd love to hear from you. Well, it now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme. Once again, to thank you for listening, and until we meet again, to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.